For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. Oklahomans are voting on five state questions on November 6th, and over the next few weeks, I wanted to get your thoughts on these measures. This week, we are looking at State Question 800, creating the Oklahoma Vision Fund and putting away a portion of gross production taxes as another savings account apart from the Rainy Day Fund. Neva, supporters say this helps in the event of a downturn similar to the one we've had in the past few years.
And I think this is the give and take. The state chamber's for it. The Oklahoma State School Boards Association is against it. It's really, do we put money into a fund like this, and then where does it go? And I think that's the point of do we have this? What is anticipated of $20 to $35 million once it finally rolls into place that can go into the general fund? And I think the critics, School Board Association and others, say we would rather not have it to kind of just dropped into this type of a fund. But obviously, they would like a clear and total access to those kind of funds going directed to education. So it will be interesting to see. This is a state question that hasn't gotten a lot of attention, hasn't gotten very much really editorial traction on either side, fairly limited. And so it will be, I think it will be very interesting to see if the voters really key in on it at the last minute and where it goes. Because at this point, I don't hear any real speculation one way or the other as to how it will land.
Any kind of polling or like that. Ryan, what do we think?
Well, it's pretty complicated. And even legislators that were considering it, I think, if you ask them to fully explain what this looks like in practice, I don't think that they could. The enabling legislation that was passed after this, that the legislature passed after this, Governor Fallon vetoed it and said that there were problems with that, and that among those problems was that part of this fund could go to relieve municipal and county debt indebtedness. And she said the state government shouldn't be relieving the debt of county and local governments that the state itself didn't incur. Senator John Sparks has been from Norman, one of the real champions of this, and has built a career in the legislature off of trying to move the legislature's reliance on revenue from the oil and gas community. And I think that that's laudable. I think that timing on this is difficult because it would cut into the taxes that were just passed on gross production that were dedicated to education. So we're going to take those new tax revenues and take a portion of that off and go into this reserve fund. But I'm with Neva. I think that it's interesting. You know, the Tulsa editorial board came out against it, but even that, you know, we've seen the chamber, though they're going to engage their members to be for it. Most voters are going to walk in, and I think the first time they're going to see this is when they walk into that ballot box and they read this ballot language. And it's going to be interesting whether or not they, because I think what it might ultimately come down to is whether or not they trust the legislature. Because if they don't understand it, they're going to have some deference to the legislature, both in what the legislature's put in front of them. And then moving forward, there's a big question as to how the legislature would use this money. And it may come down to how voters feel about trusting the legislature and how they ultimately cast their ballot.
Or it may come down to something akin to the Rainy Day Fund when it was established, mm-hmm. where the voters looked at it and I think said anything we can do to segment some of these dollars into a fund where it is there for the rainy day, it is there for stipulated purposes, the three or four that were established, in the same vein as this vision fund has been structured, then they may say, well, more of that is probably better than just leaving it the way it is. And I think that the arcane language, which I think many people say is even on either side would agree, is part of the problem in this.
Yeah.
And the complexity, just like you said, Ryan. I mean, this is one of those instances where it's a relatively good idea, I think, but whether they crafted it completely in a way that really solves problems, because the governor's veto is a perfect illustration, raising the very points that you just outlined. That may give pause if that information gets out there in a significant way. And I think that's the real question is, will there be any real significant discussion on this state question at all?
And one of the differences between this Vision Fund and the Rainy Day Fund and the other two other reserve funds that we have is that the restrictions there, I think, are greater on when the legislature can tap into those. You know, this creates a dedicated source of revenue that would immediately go into the general revenue fund at some point for the legislature to use. You know, ostensibly, they could use that for education. They could also use it for private prison bed contract. Who knows? I mean, so I think that there's a bigger question there. But again, does that really come out in the language? Can you really, as a voter, look at the language and discern this is different than these other two? There's also been a lot of talk over the last several years that we have that we've had too many off-the-top set-asides of revenue that come into the state, so that when the legislature sits down at the beginning of the legislative session, even though we have certified revenues at however many billion, you have a huge chunk of that that's already set aside for rainy day fund or transportation or whatever that municipal bond servicing, whatever that looks like, it's already off the top. So the legislature already starts off in somewhat of a hole. This is a much smaller portion than a lot of those, but it's still part of that conversation.
The Oklahoma Public Employees Association is suing the State Department of Health over the layoffs of more than 150 employees a year ago. The OPEA says the former employees were wrongfully terminated, forced to resign, or take early retirement by the department. It's asking for $3 million in compensation. Ryan, does the OPEA have a case here?
Well, the OPEA's case right now is that, and they've said it out front, is that they hope that this doesn't ever make its way to a decision before a court. I think that this is part of a process to force the state of Oklahoma to reckon with what it has done. And I think that the $3 million in damages that, if they were successful in the lawsuit, would be given to the laid off employees on a basis of, how much each one was actually hurt. There's a calculation that they've got there as to who would receive what. I think OPEA, and I don't even have to say think, because what they've said is they don't want it to come to that. I think that what they want is to have a conversation about getting these folks plugged back into their jobs and restoring the services that they were providing to the people of Oklahoma before they were laid off. And I think that everybody can agree that the layoffs were inappropriate. We now know that they didn't have to go. And so the decision of whether to bring them back or not is ultimately a political decision, because we know that the money is there and there's a decision to be made about whether or not they want to return those folks to those jobs.
Neva.
I think it's interesting. You're right, Ryan. And this basically is the start point of saying, look, we intend to sue. You have 90 days to basically, we can come to the table and try to work this out and avoid that. And I think that is the clear intent. It's bringing everyone to the table and determining whether they can really resolve this issue in an amicable way. And we would hope that would happen. I mean, when you have a grand jury report released in May that said the shortfall never existed, and then you have the instance where the OPEA, one of their contentions was that these terminations and layoffs were based on false pretense. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've got a muddy, messy situation that now involves, I think the total number was 191, but a number of those folks have moved on, and so you've really got about probably 60, something like that, of those folks. So it's a manageable number. We're not talking about these massive mm-hmm. thousands right. of folks being laid off. It's a very difficult situation that, frankly, was born out of a big mess that has been at the forefront of Oklahomans having to read about and hear about for months now. So I would hope that they could get through this and before the end of the year get it resolved so that that they can basically start with a clean slate with mm-hmm. the changing of the guard and the new administration mm-hmm. and folks coming in early next year.
Speaking of coming in next year, a couple of endorsements for gubernatorial candidates came down late last week. Republican Kevin Stitt got the backing of his primary and runoff rival Mick Cornett. Democrat Drew Edmondson got the support of the Oklahoma Education Association. Neva, let's start with Cornett supporting Stitt. Did this surprise you?
It didn't really. I think this is normal in political campaigns. as hard fought as they are and as difficult as it is sometimes to be able to kind of extend out and make that endorsement to the hard fought foe, I think the reality is, just like Mick Cornett stated, is that Kevin Stitt is the right candidate to move Oklahoma forward, and for all of the reasons that he really was running for the office of governor as well. I mean, that it's time to really correct the issues that are here in the state that we all know, and to find the kind of strong and trustworthy leadership that can unify folks and get the job done. So I think that I applaud Mick Cornett for making the endorsement, for saying he is supportive. I think that that sends a strong signal to his folks that it's time, from a party standpoint and from a unifying standpoint behind the candidate, to move forward.
Ryan, how big of a deal is that endorsement?
You know, I think that I don't know that it's that big of a deal. I don't know that Cornett commands a huge respect among the GOP base. I think that it was a big surprise for a lot of folks that he decided to run as a Republican and not as an independent. He'd governed as mayor, and his legacy right now, I think, is really in doubt, because as mayor, Mayor Cornett led by bringing multiple parties together. He was a real unifier. He transcended party politics in a lot of ways. And whenever he got into that gubernatorial race, I think a lot of his moderate and even liberal Democratic supporters that support him as mayor were surprised to see him regress into this partisan candidate who embraced all sorts of things, including, you know, Trump immigration policy, all of these things that seemed totally out of left field, or maybe right field, for Mayor Cornett and what they thought of him. And you know, now again, he's done that same thing. He's I think reflexively and in a partisan way supported the GOP ticket just as a matter of course. I think if you looked at Cornett's policies as mayor and where he wanted to take Oklahoma City, it's much more in line with where Drew Edmondson wants to take the state as governor.
Well, and so let's get to Drew Edmondson. Got the endorsement of the Oklahoma Education. It's the largest teachers union in the state. How big of a deal is that, Ryan?
Well, I think it's a huge deal. I mean, OEA has proved itself a formidable force. We saw a lot of the power of teachers at the ballot box during the primary and the runoffs when a lot of incumbents were unseated. I think we can dig into those races and see, you know, local reasons why those local politicians lost. But I think the big narrative, and in a statewide race, these big narratives count. The big narrative is that they were anti-education. And Governor, if Stitt were governor of the state of Oklahoma, you know, he's run away from Mary Fallon's endorsement, and you know, rightly so. I mean, I understand 17% approval rating. I'd want to run away from that too, but he hasn't done a lot to distinguish himself from Governor Fallon, with one exception. The one way that he has distinguished himself from Governor Fallon is that he said that he would have vetoed the compromise budget bill that put millions of dollars of new revenue into education. So in that regard, he would be even worse for education than Mary Fallon has been. So it doesn't make any surprise to me. Maybe the bigger surprise and a more telling one is that he was asked to name his favorite teacher from high school. And then when the Frontier contacted that that teacher, my understanding is that teacher said that they're voting for Drew Edmondson.
Neva, what did you think about this endorsement? Again, it's the largest one, union of teachers.
I think endorsements matter, particularly to the group, to the group's membership. To say that the Cornett endorsement doesn't help Stitt, I think, is incorrect. I think it does. The OEA endorsement for Edmondson, I mean, historically, the OEA has supported more Democratic candidates in not only statewide races, but at the local level. That had been trending differently with a Republican-dominated legislature and a Republican governor in office. That, for the last 8 years, certainly had been a different trend that was going on. So it'll be interesting to see what the relationship and how effective they can be at the legislature if there is a Governor Stitt and if there is a strongly controlled Republican legislature next year. You know, how will that affect them as this large association from the education standpoint?
Right, and that's where it gets to is Cornett's not going to go out to his supporters and say, hey, make sure you vote for these. But the Oklahoma Education Association is going to go out to its members and say, hey.
Even if Cornett does do that, he doesn't have the cadre of folks that are going to go out around the state in key precincts and deliver votes, go to doors, drag people to the polls. And, you know, I think that, you know, Neva was talking about this idea of, you know, where OEA would be, or really where the state would be if we continue with one party rule. And, you know, I think Oklahomans, and one of the real advantages that Drew Edmondson has right now is that Oklahomans have experienced one party rule now for almost a decade, and have really seen that even in those instances where they've agreed with the Republican Party, not having any sort of checks, or the only checks being these internal behind the scenes closed door checks, is not the way government should work. And I think that if Oklahoma voters are savvy enough to realize there's going to be a Republican majority legislature after the November elections, Democrats may make some gains, but the Republicans are still going to have those majorities. And that if they want to have a check in the state of Oklahoma on the legislature, the only way to do that is to elect Drew Edmondson as governor.
The Cherokee Nation slams U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren after she got a DNA test to prove she has Native American heritage. This came after getting nicknamed Pocahontas by President Trump and after he said he would give $1 million to charity to see if she took the test. Neva, what did you think about this reaction from a former Democratic lawmaker,
well,
Chuck Hoskins?
I thought the rebuke was just a
correction. It's Chuck Hoskins' son is the Secretary of State.
Oh, it wasn't the same Chuck Hoskins.
Yeah, so it's Chuck Hoskins Jr. He's the Secretary of State for the Cherokee Nation.
I never knew. Somebody should have explained that to
now,
me.
Now, Chuck Hoskins is still a member of the cabinet of the Cherokee Nation.
But that's not the Chuck Hoskins that was on NPR.
Different Chuck Hoskins.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay, we learned something.
That's what should have been known to that. Okay,
well, I do think Monday's rebuke was really fairly striking. It's a rarity to see that strong a statement made, whether it's from a tribal leader or anyone. And I think looking at it being a direct confrontation with Elizabeth Warren, someone who's widely being speculated as a 2020 presidential candidate, the fact that she has tried to embrace and hold on to this idea of Native American heritage, and then to have it slammed so strongly the other direction, I think this is something that'll haunt her now politically on the campaign trail if she moves forward. And it'll be interesting to see how as it gets more attention and traction, how that really affects the potential voters looking at her as a serious candidate.
And although Chuck Hoskins Jr. Came out against this, I don't remember seeing Chuck Hoskins Jr. coming out when Trump was saying Pocahontas and saying all the other things that he said.
So Chief Bill John Baker did. So the chief of the Cherokee Nation, Bill John Baker, did come to Senator Warren's defense whenever Trump on the campaign trail began this, you know, very racist attack towards Elizabeth Warren at that time. And Bill John Baker said, you know, he was grateful for Elizabeth Warren saying that she had some kinship with indigenous people. But he said that, you know, she is not, at that point, she wasn't claiming that she was a member of the Cherokee Nation. She wasn't a member of a tribe. And he said, you know, I wish more people in government felt like they had some sort of a connection to the native peoples of the United States of America. And so he came to her defense at that point. Now, what she did this week was just a regrettable error of the umpteenth degree. And I woke up that morning and saw the email from her, you know, touting this and this video and this whole thing. And I'm thinking, how do you think that this is a good idea? And it really makes a mockery of what it means to be a member of a tribe. You know, tribal membership, tribal citizenship is not something that you can determine by going to 23andme.com. And it undermines the sovereignty of these nations. These nations get to decide who is and who is not a member of those tribes.
Right.
And, you know, you don't get to do that through a DNA test.
But she never claimed that she was actually, she said she might have Cherokee hair. All she was doing was proving that she had some kind of Native
American. 1/1000th of something percent I think that it's laughable. I think that if she were really sincere about this, you know, the first thing that she would have done would have been to continue to have a conversation with the Cherokee Nation, you know, rather than to have this public fight with the Cherokee Nation and have Chuck Hoskins Jr., who I think was entirely right in his condemnation of what she's done and what she's alleging. She should have called Chief Baker or Secretary of State Chuck Hoskins Jr. and said, you know, how can I respond to this? I want to do this in a way that's respectful to the tribe. I want to do this in a way that's respectful to the nation and to tribal sovereignty and to advance the issues that the people of tribes around the country are facing. I think that she really believes that. I think that she's made a huge misstep here, and it's going to be very difficult for her to have that productive conversation. Now, I hope that she still will, though. I think that it's not too late. I think that if she reached out to Chief Bill John Baker right now and said, I messed up, I stepped in it, yeah, and you know, I want to make amends for this.
Right. And Hoskins did actually say that Trump should not have also said about the Pocahontas.
Right, right. Yeah. Right.
Everyone is kind of saying these things, and they're forgetting that there are indigenous people who are trapped in the middle of this.
Well, and the statement was so strong. I mean, when you say that it makes a mockery not only of the DNA tests and the legitimate uses, but you go on to say that it dishonors legitimate tribal governments and their citizens. I mean, those are strong statements that don't go away very easily. Yes, I mean, if you want to stay in the political fray and you want to move forward with some national campaign, you certainly are going to have to address it and put this down as best as possible. But it's there to stay, and unfortunately, you're right. I mean, for someone to make this type of just colossal miscue and misfire, it really raises a lot of other questions, and I think legitimately so.
Especially in these southwestern states where it means a lot.
Well, and just, I tried to imagine, you know, what kind of a meeting was happening in the Elizabeth Warren, because ostensibly this is happening in the context of her U.S. Senate campaign.
It wasn't happening in Oklahoma.
Well, and, you know, how is it that there's not a single person in that room who says, this is not respectful, this is
right,
disrespectful.
Right, right. Raise all the issues that ultimately were what were in the release.
And you know, so I think that, I hope that there can be a productive conversation out of this. Ultimately, you know, I have a lot more faith that Senator Warren can thoughtfully respond to this in a way that we haven't seen out of Donald Trump. I
mean, Donald Trump's
comments, all that are racist. I mean, there's just no ifs, ands, or buts mm-hmm. about it. I mean, there are racist attacks meant to attack a political opponent and to gin up some of his base. But at the end of the day, Senator Warren should have known better than to do this, and I'm hoping that she's working to make amends.
But from a political standpoint, we're a week into this of having taken place, and yet seeing nothing out of Senator Warren. So that raises another big question: is how long and why so long before there's some really serious attempt to try to rectify the situation?
And timing's a real question here as well. Why did she do this a few weeks before the midterm elections? I mean, she's got a U.S. Senate race in Massachusetts that she's most likely going to win. And, you know, if she wants to begin, I mean, she's already started this idea of a presidential campaign. I don't think she's probably the least doubtful of any of the Democratic contenders as to whether or not they're going to get into the presidential race for 2020. But if she really wanted to have this conversation, why not have this conversation the week after the midterms? Yeah. Why begin this conversation today? There's just so many logistical and strategic misfires here, not the least of which is that, you know, she made a real mockery and added real insult to the people of the Cherokee Nation and other tribes in the state of Oklahoma and around the country.
Very quickly, in what appears to be a modern-day equivalent to a call for a duel, Oklahoma Congressman Mark Wayne Mullen is challenging the attorney for Stormy Daniels, Michael Avenatti, to a mixed martial arts fight. The challenge comes after a week after Avenatti challenged Donald Trump Jr. to an MMA fight. Neva, what do you think of the three-term congressman making this call?
Neva just checked her watch.
How quickly can I answer this question?
Well, publicity stunts, I mean, that they go to a new level. I mean, both in this instance, I think throwing it out there is a possibility. I think Mark Wayne Mullen, I mean, you would have to, here's a guy who wrestled in college, wrestled in high school, someone who has been an MMA fighter in the past to some degree. I mean, he would be formidable, and it certainly would, from a charity standpoint, I guess you could say it would be an opportunity for some charity to benefit from a lot of money being raised. I don't think it goes anywhere, but it certainly in this closing stretch of the political season, at least everybody can step back and smile and take note.
And Ryan,
who said chivalry's dead? You come into the defense of Donald Jr. I mean, that's just real cute. I like that. It's real sweet of him to come to his defense like that. I think that if Mark Wayne Mullen wants to hang up his congressional belt and pick up his MMA belt and open up that second district some representation that we can be proud of again. all power to him. You know, I have a lot more confidence in his ability in the MMA ring than I do in Congress.
Well, I think Congressman Mullen, I think we'll expect to see him back next year in Congress, and this will just be one of those things that, frankly, the voters in his district may find a pleasant change in just the conversation from some of the stuff that's going on this political
season.
Well,
it's getting a little chilly outside, so, you know, we start we're getting close to Festivus, and you know, this just is another feats of strength. So we're going to have the midterms, which are the airing of grievances. So maybe after this, Mark Wayne Mullen can engage in the feats of strength with Avenatti.
Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.